a Motorsport Podcast Network production. Hi everybody, Aaron Noonan here. Welcome again to the V8 Salute Podcast powered by Repco. It's great to have you on board for our latest episode. Now my guest is Charlie Schwerkholt, and this is the first of a two-part chat with the Team 18 Supercars team owner. But before I get into telling you about what's on this episode, I have to remind you about a couple of podcasts that you need to listen to as well. The Castrol Motorsport News Podcast is every Tuesday. Subscribe so you don't miss the latest news and views on Aussie and world motorsport. That's with Stefan Bartholomaeus and Andrew Van Leeuwen. And I'm back with you on Repco Supercars Weekly every Thursday. So with V8 Sleuth Podcast on Wednesday, Castrol MN Tuesday, Repco Supercars Weekly Thursday, we have got you covered for your podcast fix of motorsport every week. Now, my guest this week, as I said, is Charlie Schwerkholt. And in part one of our chat, he talks about a bunch of stuff. We talk about the family business and how it wasn't always forklifts to start with. We talk about how he got interested in motorsport and his years with Dick Johnson Racing. The ups, the downs, how it began and how it ended. All told from his perspective. So here we go, buckle up, it's time to start part one of Charlie Schwerkholt on the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco. Charlie Schwerkholt, we are sitting at Team 18. We are in like the nerve center. We're in your office, mate. Thank you for having us. This is, I feel special. This is big ticket stuff.
Fantastic. Thanks. Thanks again for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. Appreciate it. Great to have you here for sure.
Now, there's a lot to cover off here. We've got a lot of questions from our fans and our followers on V8 Sleuth. There's a lot to cover in your motor racing journey, but I also wanted to talk a bit of business and a bit of upbringing and a bit of this stuff. But where does the car thing, and I ask this of a lot of our guests, but where's the car thing bite? Where does it grab a hold of you? Is it your mum and dad? I remember you telling me that they're hardcore into Studebakers.
Yeah.
And they formed a car club. Is that where it all started for you, that ends up with this madness of running a two-car supercars team?
Yeah, it's crazy. Back in when I was a kid, I think it was very mid-60s, somewhere around there, that mum and Dad drove an old Studebaker, and they decided to form the Studebaker Car Club. I think it was 67 or 68, somewhere around there. And I remember as a young fella, we lived in Mount Waverley, and I'd go out in my pyjamas of a night and go and look at all the cars in the street because the meetings were held there. And then it sort of grew and used to go to car racing, mainly at Sandown.
I was going to say that's your local track, so yeah.
Perfect. Correct, yeah. So I used to go down there with Dad and see the likes of Beachy and Moffat and all them race around there, and rode my bike down there plenty of times. And yeah,
on school days or weekends?
No. It was always always good like that. But I always had this involvement in cars, and even at school, I did some naughty things of driving a mate's car at every lunchtime and going down the little lanes in Camberwell with cars. I thought, how good is this? You'd see if you could get to third gear and drive down the lane and slam on the brakes, and you'd have to reverse back because you didn't want to go out in the road and turn around because you didn't have a license. But always the passion of cars and car racing, and really loved it. It was great.
Did you have a hero back in those days? You talked about Beachy and Moffat and those guys. Was there anyone who was a standout that you were a hardcore fan of?
Oh, I'd have to say Norm Beachy. Yeah. Loved his Monaro, loved the, you know, those cars then. But I've got to say Bond too now, of course. Colin Bond.
He's got a connection to Bondy, yeah.
He's a mate. But yeah, I watched them all, you know, even McEwen in the Porsche and all that sort of stuff, those very early days. But probably my favourite car was Moffat's Mustang. That was just the best-looking car.
Classic.
Best-looking car.
Trans Am, 69 Mustang.
Absolutely.
Won a bunch of races. It's the car that made him, really, wasn't it? It's
absolutely.
It wasn't a Studebaker.
No.
It wasn't quite a Studio. Studebaker larks were punting around in touring cars in the 60s at Bathurst. But in those days, you had to have a small car to win Bathurst, not the big car.
Correct. I remember sitting the top of the mountain with mum and dad in the late 60s as a kid. I think there's photos of, I think his name was Needham, Bert Needham, driving in.
And Warren Weldon.
Correct. Yeah. In that, I think it was a 64 Studi Lark, and dad actually ended up buying that car many, many years later. And,
the race car?
Yeah, he ended up buying it, but he sold it, and I remember seeing it at the Bathurst Museum many, many years ago. So, but yes, I remember those days very, very well.
Oh, if only he kept that, that'd
yes,
be worth it.
Yes, absolutely.
But it's like every collectible race car. It's not collectible when you've got it. It's collectible down the track when three other people have bought it, and it's now worth six times what, you know, anyone paid for it at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me too about, we'll get on to, you know, we'll get into the racing. I know our listeners are right in the racing, but one thing that I'm enthralled about is, so Waverley Forklifts didn't start with forklifts though, when I sat down and did some homework on this. Tell me about the family business and what it was before it was forklifts. Because we know you as, you know, I think there's some people around that call you Charlie Forklifts because that's what your business is.
Yeah.
But it's not always been that way.
No, we were one of the first settlers out in Melbourne in the mid-1850s and my great-great-grandfather got into empty bottles, of collecting empty bottles and selling them to all the wineries or the breweries and all that sort of stuff. And even before Carlton United Breweries, they were selling beer bottles to all the independent breweries like Carlton Brewery, Abbott's Brewery and all those sort of breweries. So that's what the family did way back in the late 1800s.
And where did they come from?
They came from Germany or a town near Berlin called Prussia, it was back then, and they came out then. And I'm fifth generation, Schwerkamp, and they eventually settled out in Nunawading, started in Northcote, ended up in Nunawading, collecting bottles, and then they the business started in Paran. So it was collecting bottles and then washing bottles for all the breweries and all the wineries. So that's how it all began. And then my grandfather did it, my father did it, and I did it too as a kid, and collecting bottles as well after school, and had my own areas of housing commission areas where there was loads and loads of bottles. And
target-rich environment there.
So there was a lot of fun in collecting bottles, a lot of hard work. It was a hard way to make money, but that's what the family did. And unfortunately, all the rules changed in the early 70s. You didn't need a bottle merchant back then. You could put your bottles out in the nature strip. So Dad changed the business model. He had a couple of forklifts left over, and then he thought, what am I going to do with them? And so he started to rent them out. And so he started Waverley Forklifts back in 73, which ironically next year turns 50, which is
anniversary. Yeah,
a big anniversary for us. And then I joined in 76 as doing bottles and also as an apprentice mechanic and a forklift mechanic, and grew it from there. And here we are today, the largest independent forklift company in Australia, with over 4,000 machines in every state in Australia.
So you've got over 4,000 now. How many were there at the start, two or three?
We started at two, and when I joined, I think it was 12, and then Dad and I came up. I sort of took over the reins in the very late 80s, and I think there was about 50 machines, and Dad thought, this is too big at 50. This is way too big. So, yes, and
you look at it now. You knew about now.
Jeez. I know. So, yeah, no, I'm really proud of the business. It's a great business with some amazing people.
So you actually, I did a little bit of sleuthing, as it is, right, on the Waverley Forklifts website. So it says there that you did your diesel apprenticeship.
Yep.
So 77, good year for Ford fans, by the way. Moffat, Bond, 1-2, all that sort of stuff. So your dad retires, you take over. Could you have ever imagined that it would become what it is now? I mean, I don't think there's anyone who sets out in a business. You want it to be successful. But to increase it, I haven't done the quick percentages on how many you had then and how many you got now. There's no way you could envisage that as a grand plan and hope and dream.
No, not at all. It's bigger and better than I ever thought. You know, if when I first got to 1,000 machines, this is it. No bigger. That's it. Now I remember. Well, actually, I remember getting to 100, and I thought I was like, this is like, I'm Alan Bond back in the day. And
well, that didn't go so well for him.
It didn't go bad anyway. But no, look, it's fantastic. It's so big. It's, you know, we're really proud of where we've gone. And we've had our rocky roads like any business, and COVID hit pretty hard. You know, there was 500 machines came back. I remember the day after the Grand Prix in 2020, we were told we're going to pack up the Grand Prix. This is it. And they all came back after that. And I thought, wow, this isn't good. But, you know, we soldiered on. We've really gone well, and it's here we are building the Grand Prix at the moment, and there's 160-odd forklifts down at the Grand Prix, so it's massive.
I should point out to our listeners, we're having the chat before the Grand Prix. This is probably going to air after the Grand Prix, so you're probably listening to this by the stage that those forklifts are whizzing around, pulling it all apart again rather than setting it all up at the point. But the Grand Prix relationship, that's probably – is that the first motor racing – business connection for Waverley and got you, I mean, it doesn't quite get you to supercar team land, but it gets you exposed to the sport and a business deal with the sport, really.
Yeah, look, because we're known for can-do attitude. And I think the first Grand Prix coming from Adelaide, then it came to Melbourne, of course, in 96, they used a supplier there that just couldn't deliver. And so we were approached then. It's a bit of a joint venture with Lynn Fox. It was back then, it was Main Logistics, but they supply all the staff and build it. And we supply all the equipment from the fencing, the blocks, the grandstands, and putting all this together with all that. And so we've been going 27 years now, or 26 years, missed a couple because of COVID.
But yeah, no one's fault.
Yeah, as I said before, you know, there's 160-odd machines there. There's not another company in Australia that could do it. But and that from there, it's grown on to other supercar events and supply equipment to the Newcastle event and the Adelaide 500, of course. We did a lot at that, and looks like we'll get that back again. Mm-hmm. So it'll be a busy time of the year, and that always conflicted with the Grand Prix for us. It was very, very difficult.
That time of the year, yeah.
Doing
yeah.
the Adelaide 500 and the Grand Prix, it was very, very difficult. We couldn't do the whole lot in Adelaide, so it just didn't work. But now, if that's on it.
If there's anyone who likes the season finale, it's definitely you then.
Absolutely. So bring it on right at the end. That'll be great because then we can go that and then roll straight into the Grand Prix, which is exciting. So, right.
I've got some more fan questions for a bit later, but there was one that I saw that came through, and this links a little bit back to something I wanted to ask you about. I think it may have been your own team that have asked this. They want to know who would win in a go-kart race, between you, Frosty, and Scotty Pye. And now you did a bit of karting in your younger days, which a lot of our listeners might not know, but tell us a little bit about that and a little bit about who would win this race, because I feel when I get asked questions by teams for podcasts – they're loaded. There's something in them and there's a story or a reason why they're asking.
So, yeah, back in the, I don't know, in the 80s and 90s, I joined Oakley Go-Kart Club with a mate and I was in Clubman Light and went through the ranks there and I was a fairly handy steerer, I think. And I think I came fifth in an Australian title at Brooklyn before that closed. So I could steer all right.
Was there any familiar names we would know that you were racing in that?
Yeah, there was I was Ritter was there and
Greg Ritter,
yes,
yeah.
Dougal McDougal, was there racing, and there was quite a few. I can't remember them all at the moment, but there was quite a few. But we're running around at Oakley, and it was a little bit older then. But if we had a race today, I might keep out of Frosty's way because he might turf me around after seeing him in Tassie just recently. But I've got a bit of a name of just a little bit of a nudge behind and just push him off a little bit. And so we've all been on the track together, and I reckon I'm right in the middle there somewhere between second, sometimes first.
Yeah,
and we'll swap around a little bit and always up there for a go, that's for sure. But it's a lot of fun. I love getting on a cart. And when we have our sponsor days, it's always between Frosty and Scotty and myself who can get up there.
Are they the days that they've got to send out the checkered flag 43 times because you're still going round and round? It's like, get him in. We've got to go home. Come on.
That's it. Yeah, no, it's a lot of fun and love doing it. But Frosty will get me and Scotty. Only just. I'm always there third, but yeah.
Oh, well, just use the bumper. The bumper.
That's it.
So we've Grand Prix, Waverley forklifts, we're going to V8 supercars. And this all comes out of I think you've told me this before, this story. You went with some mates on a trip to, was it Winton, I think, and somehow out of it all, someone that Dick and Jilly Johnson end up on the plane getting a ride back from that round, and it's all just, it went from there.
Really. Yeah, correct. A mate of mine, Gary, we chartered a plane. It was a little 10-seater plane, one of those little propeller jobs, and we go up to Benalla. Oh,
a few people edgy getting on those ones.
And we go up to Benalla, and it was I think we had a, you know, in the paddock club or whatever it was then, because I was always going to the races, and then there was a couple of seats on the way back, we offered Dick a ride, and I think it might have been just Dick and John Bow. I can't remember. I don't know who we came, but I know Dick was there, and I sat next to him and wanted to know what I was up to, the whole thing, and I'm into forklifts, and Dick being Dick wanted, you know.
A deal,
and it was a good deal, and we came up with a deal of me sponsoring the team. Me giving Dick a forklift. and painted all in shell colours. I remember, you know, it was red and the yellow and all that sort of stuff, had shell on it and all that sort of stuff. And this was 2001 when the AU Ford was running around. And so we came up with a deal, and he gave me a hot lamp, he gave me a door, which I've still got, and bits and pieces and tickets to the races. And I thought, this is a good deal. And it got me close to the action of car race. I thought, wow, how good is this? So I was pretty chuffed at the time and built a relationship with Dick in 2002 and onwards.
There's a lot of people who run businesses and race teams, and you were passionate about and into it, but where did it become that the fusion between the two makes a very good business sense, where you can use your involvement? I mean, obviously you've got your own team now, that's a, you know, next level, but whether you're sponsoring a car, a driver, an event, being a supplier somewhere, to make it make business sense. There's not many people in the sport that can and have done that. They usually run it, I mean, the passion usually overrules all of that stuff. At what point did you see that the two could click together, that an involvement in racing beyond your passion was good for your business, and what sort of things was it good for?
It opens up, for me, it opened up a whole new set of doors. The doors were just, instead of forklift people, these are all businesses that were sponsoring DJR at the time, and all these doors opened everywhere. So I was getting forklift deals as well.
Because they're sponsors who've got warehouses, correct, and they've got stock, and they've got stuff that needs to be moved, and
correct,
they need forklifts. So
it opened doors everywhere, yeah, and introduced me to a whole new world of people. And then the exposure, the whole thing, and I thought, this makes sense. This really, really makes sense. And then I started putting Waverley forklifts on the car. I think it was 05 and 06, the West Point and the first Rock days. And I started putting my name on the car, and this is working. I'm getting business out of this. And, I thought it was great. It was really good.
Were there any other sports that you looked at the time? Because we do see some businesses try a bit of everything to start with to see what grabs, and then hone in on one or two that really grab. Well, you'd seen enough in motor racing to go, that works for me. Let's do that.
For sure. And still today, we entertain in the sport with our own customers, Waverley Forklifts. We entertain, we take corporate facilities, and we looked at we still do a little bit of the footy with the Medallion Club and all that sort of stuff. But the prime thing is our customers getting involved in a race team. They feel part of it. They get all the newsletters, and it's really, we're really close with businesses that really support my own team and all that sort of stuff. But we just found it really, really worked.
Medallion Club makes me think of footy. Who do you barrack for?
St Kilda. Oh, sorry.
They've got to be due. Like, seriously,
how many?
We've had the Richmond drought break. We've had the Bulldogs drought break. Who else have we had in more recent years? We've broken some droughts with some footy clubs.
I know.
Surely you've got to be next in line.
Absolutely.
Surely. Seriously.
Had a sponsor back in 2013-14, which was Geldwin, which was a big sponsor of St Kilda back then. And, of course, we had two grand finals then, and still didn't get across the line. But it's due. Could it's be this due. Year, you never know.
You never know. Well, Melbourne got there for a long time.
Oh, I know.
You never know. Hold the faith. I'm a poor struggling Hawthorn supporter. We haven't won for like a whole 7 years. Like, wow. That's tough.
You know, St Kilda's like, 66. I know. It's a long time ago.
It's been funny though. It's you'll get there. Jared Ruffhead's at the Saints now, so I'm good with the Saints. That's okay for me.
Yeah.
So we've met Dick. We've got involved. We're doing forklift deals. We're sponsoring the car. In early 2008, you end up buying part of the team, coming in as a team owner and executive position as well. Clearly, there'd been rough waters for the team in a couple of years before that. That's all pretty well known, the West Point stuff, the First Rock stuff. Was that a position where you were looking to do that, or was it a case of a situation presented and let's get in and have a go at this?
Yeah, at the end of 2007, you know, Dick and I were very close. We'd go boating together. We'd do all sorts of stuff together and had a good relationship. And he asked me a few times, do you want to buy the team, you know, half the team? The whole lot.
Yeah.
And I said no every time. I said no. Look, I don't want to – the friendship, the whole thing, and no, I don't want to do it. No, it's okay. And, of course, then he got – Trying to think of his name now, the property guy.
John Marshall.
John Marshall, of course.
Marcus's dad.
That's it. He, they did a deal at Christmas time. It's all happening, 2007, it's all done, which, you know, I'll still be part, I'll, you know, the whole thing, and it's great. And, of course, it tipped over right at the last minute. And the banks were swirling around big time, and Dick sort of pleaded, I need a hand here, I need a hand, by just 50%, anything. So I agreed, and we all stepped up. Phil Baldock from Jim Beam stepped up, myself, and put it all together at very, very short notice. I remember all the meetings on the Gold Coast, put it together in like days, and got it all happening. And in the meantime, the cars were getting rebuilt by 888, all new 888. This is the BF then, changing from BA to BF, and all getting rebuilt with all the latest 888 spec gear. And the team hadn't won for since 2001
was that year that you talked about before, yeah.
Hadn't won anything for 7 or 8 years, 7 years. So this is, I think they got one podium in the Shell car of 03 or 04 with Max Wilson
at Eastern
that's
Creek.
That's it, good memory, around. Yes, yeah, I remember right. that. And yep. other than that, it was a complete dry spell. And so, you know, we had Adrian Burgess as the team manager. It was all put together, and the funding was sort of nearly there, and let's try and make it work. So we did.
Had you not done that deal to buy in, would DJR have been there?
No, all gone. 100% all gone, unless he found someone else.
Which but was time sticking.
It was days and days. The bank, they're knocking on the door, and I said no probably a couple of times. No, look.
No to buying the whole thing, no to buying a bit of it, no to buying any of it.
Correct. I said no a couple of times, and it didn't really stack up. The figures, it doesn't really stack up. And what do I know about running a race team? But if I've got to put my money in, I want a control of being the managing director and see where we can take it. So I did, came on board, and that was February 08, I'm it, and commuted from Melbourne. I was living in Melbourne at the time, commuted up there, and here we go, try and put it together. And, of course, the first race was Eastern Creek with Will Davison.
Worked all right.
Got a win. I'm thinking this is pretty
easy,
isn't it?
This is easy.
This is really easy. But, of course, no. Great driver, great equipment, brand new equipment, the uprights and everything, and the 888 gear, it was a success for the first race, it was a good year.
It was a very good year because I think Will won again at Winton.
Correct.
He and Stevie J were third at Phillip Island in the 500K race. They were regular top 5, 10 cars rather than 10 to 15 where they'd kind of been before the Jim Beam era had kicked in. So at this stage, what's your role in the team? You own half of it. What's your day-to-day role that you're in control of there?
Managing director, liaising with Adrian Burgess, the team manager, making sure the sponsor's happy, bringing the sponsors on, any new ones, and making sure it stacks up financially, which was tough. There was still a lot of the old DJR stuff that we had to wash through, and there was a lot of stuff there from the past that we had to get rid of. There was merch deals. There was boats in there. There was all sorts of stuff that we had to wash through, and it was a big job. Yeah, and of course it was a family business too, you know. Dick's was heading it up, and it's a big change for him. His brother Dino was there, truck driver. Stevie J was driving, and I think his sister Kelly, she was doing merch and stuff. So it was a, you know, it was a family business with a lot of heritage and pedigree that was, you know, needed to change in lots of ways, and I go about starting to change it to a proper business as well.
And is it where you're trying to change things that the issues start? Because from you arriving in an ownership capacity, Febo 8 to 2010, the end of that championship with James winning in Sydney, and that's kind of the end of your line there, although it had been, you know, fractured before. It's a short amount of time. It's not a huge, it's like just less than 3 years to go from buying in, winning a championship, and it all, you know, not
dissolved.
Working. It dissolved, yeah.
Correct.
So where, looking back on it now, did it start to dissolve? Or what was it a case of, because you put money in, you wanted to have some decision-making, you want to try to steer the ship in the right way, some of your decisions, some of the things you want to do are going against what the Johnsons want to do, I guess, is probably the best way to describe it.
Absolutely. And when you really break it down, Dick didn't really want to have a business partner.
He kind really, of needed to.
He just needed to, of course. And it was a family business, and he didn't really want to, but he needed to. So I had to make it a proper business, you know, had the runs on the board as a business, not so much a race team, but it's the same principles of the sponsors, the drivers, performance. And of course, Stephen, you know, I had one, you know, in 2010, you know, got one car in first and one down the pecking order. And then the stories begin of trying to, you know, make it work.
Mm.
And it was difficult, very, very, very difficult time.
One of the things that springs in my mind, so Will left to go to HRT, Mark Scaife retired at the, yeah, that's right, the end of 08, so he takes the seat there. James Courtney comes along, he's been at Stone Brothers for a few years, but he comes across to Jim Beam Racing. FG is new too because it's a whole new platform and car, so 888 build. I think they built like six or seven of them in a batch and you guys got two. So it was a unique scenario. The team had never not built or run its own cars, which was a whole new thing. But did the James Courtney signing rub things the wrong way with Dick? Because I remember he's written in his book that he was pretty cool with the fact that James Courtney was coming to the team. He was, you know, a great driver, but the deal had been done without him being involved. Is that how you recall it?
Yeah. Look, Adrian and I were working for a replacement for Will. We didn't want to lose Will. We tried to keep him, but he went to
HR2,
over there, and the factory deal, and so we had to replace him. And James at the time was all committed to Tickford or FPR at those days. He was all committed.
He's had a couple of goes there over the years. He made it eventually.
He did make it, and he was all committed. And so we're looking around, and then Alan Gow rang Adrian and said, "Hey, listen, have you got a seat?" And Adrian said, "Yep, we're going to do this quick. We can do the deal." And of course, I'm the managing director of the team. I did it. We couldn't muck around the whole thing. So yeah, I did the deal, and without Dick knowing, I guess. And it was a bit of a surprise to Dick. And of course, I remember him saying he costs too much money and he crashes cars. You've seen what he does at Stone Brothers.
He had crashed a few in his time, it should be said before that though too. But
And I said, it's going to work. It will work. This is the real deal. But yeah, Dick was pretty shitty at the time, and maybe it was a mistake of mine. I should have involved him but he probably wouldn't have liked the money we were going to spend at the time. You're only going to spend and you only get what you pay for, and it was big money. It was a lot more than what we all wanted, but he was obviously going to deliver. But the first race was Adelaide 500. He crashed.
I was going to say what happened. Yeah.
Next race, he crashed. I think it was Tassie. And I think the next race, he crashed. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, what have I done here? Maybe Dick was completely right, and I've screwed up here. But obviously, I think we got him to 9th or 10th in 2009. We got through, and it was a very, very rocky year. And I thought, you know, wow, this is big. But, yes, and obviously 2010 was a different story.
In 2009, there's a win in Townsville, I remember.
Because
he was fast, but it blew up on the Saturday, but he came back and won Sunday. I think he won at Sydney the last round as well. So there were some highs there, although he had to patch a pile of points up from the first few rounds where he let a few leak away. So it took a little while to get back there.
I never forget the Grand Prix. We had to use an old BF.
That's right. That's true.
Wrap it in Jim King, you know, the whole old series car to get that's because right. if you didn't race, you
– I think that was Grant Denyer's DVS car from my memory. That's right. 100%. The
Grimsafe car. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Dead right. And I never forget that. So, yes. Went all right, actually.
Yeah, not bad. Not bad for an old thing.
Yeah.
At what point – so 08, you know, pretty much where the team had been really struggling. So 08, there's belief and there's a little bit of champagne. 09, there's some crashes, there's some more champagne. But in 10, it clicks together. Was there a point there where you wanted to find another driver and to move Stephen Johnson out, and that's what really probably then really escalated the tension of the Johnsons and you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I you know, I had meetings with Jim Beam and they sort of said, you know, what's the future for Stephen? Because I, you know, we're pretty keen to sign a new 3-year deal. We're going to sign a brand new deal.
And this is what,
2010.
In
early 2010, you know, our deal was up, two-car deal. It was big money and we had to get this sorted and, you know, we want to keep James, which we had another year to go with James as well. It was a 3-year deal.
Driving contract-wise.
Yeah, I think so. Oh, maybe not. I can't remember now, but anyway. So, yeah, we looked at other drivers and I put them forward to Jim Beam and they were pretty keen. We even tried to get Will back and there was all sorts of stuff of getting other drivers on board. But obviously Dick wasn't happy. He believed Stephen wasn't getting the right gear and everything's focused on car 18 and all that sort of stuff. But it wasn't. We just had to look for someone else. Mm. And that's when it all sort of broke down. And then it started.
And the great sadness of it all, and, you know, I have a relationship with you, I have a relationship with Dick and Stephen. I'm a neutral here. But ultimately, it's just a sad scenario where I remember. So the year of 2010, for our listeners who might not remember, James has a great year. He gets on a roll with the soft tyre races at Winton and Ipswich, where he goes 4 in a row, I think, from memory. He wins at Sandown late in the year, by which point you and Dick aren't talking. Like the thing's, you know, really fractured. And then in Sydney, I remember seeing you there in your Jim Beam gear, but you can't, I think there was even a point where you might not have even been there because you were kind of there as you, not as part of the it was just ultimately as someone sitting by going, this is just sad that on this grand day that you should all be celebrating, you're all celebrating but separately. And it just seems so strange and so weird and shouldn't have been that way. But this is life and that's how it worked out. But do you look back on that year? I mean, we're 12 years down the track. It's scary how fast time's gone.
Yeah.
The success of the fact that the team went from in 3 years to becoming the champion, or do you look back at the feeling of the disagreements and the fracturing of the relationship? Has one overtaken the other in when you feel back and look back at 2010, or is there – it's all part of the whole mix and it's a mixture of emotion, I guess you'd say?
Yeah, look, it was a very public breakup. You know, we're in auto action every week. What's going on? They're still not talking. One's at pit lane on the wall, one's hidden in the background and all that sort of stuff. And it was Bathurst was probably the worst. Adrian resigned. And there's
at the round
in the
so
beginning.
That's when he dropped the bomb that he's
he dropped
going
the bomb.
To
I'm not
going to
stay
place.
Because obviously I had a deal done, which was a messy deal in the end, obviously, with Nathan Tinkler to buy me out, buy my share out, and because Dick and I couldn't come up with a deal. In fact, we actually had a bit of a mediation hearing. What are we going to do? I had one of my business managers and Dick had Wayne Caddick and we all got together and put it all together and see what we could do. And it came out that I buy Dick out and came up with a really good deal for Dick, that he stays, we become really good friends again and he stays with the team and he gets paid and he gets a merchandise range and the money from model cars and all the old stuff. And it was a really good deal, I thought. So I was buying him out.
Would it have stayed as Dick Johnson Racing?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But the 20, 30-year, you know, thing is Dick Johnson Racing, the whole thing. And it was a good deal. And we shook hands. Okay, this is the way to go. Okay, so I never forget going back to the office. Geez, I'm going to buy the whole team.
And this is like mid-2010?
Mid-2010 and probably July, August, somewhere around there. And I thought, wow, this is it. This is big. But anyway, I'm looking forward to it. Moved up to Queensland to live up there, close to the team. This is what I was going to do. And Dick came in the next day. I've got a better deal. I've got someone that's going to buy you out for a lot more money and it's going to be better. I get control of the team and what I want to do, not what you want to do. And I said, Dick, you know what? If that's what you want to do, I'm happy. So we shook hands and he had a guy called Nathan Tinkler, he's going to buy me out this time. So it was a bit sad, obviously, but in that time I thought, well, you know what? I like the sport. I know what sort of goes on and what to do. I ended up buying a wreck off Craig Wilson at HRT. They were going from four cars down to three cars.
They were two HRTs and two Bundys.
Correct.
At the end of 2010, they'd run Fabian Coulthard and Andrew Thompson. I remember that vividly because Andrew Thompson lived at my house that year.
Right.
He bought it when he moved to Melbourne, and then they stripped back to one Bundy car.
Right.
So, and I, you know, at the time, a wreck was, you know, they were pretty valuable types of things, and they were
massive.
There weren't many around.
There was very few. But anyway, HRT decided we're going to go from four cars to three cars. I'm thinking this is, the timing's good. And so.
So thought, you sell your share at EJR and go off and buy your own wreck. Is your plan.
Correct.
So win. Dick gets control.
He gets control. He gets a new partner, happy.
You get paid. You buy a thing to do your own thing.
Fantastic.
This sounds all right.
And I'm in the process. I've got a few deals on the go here. Obviously, doing my deal with Nathan Tinkler. Finally, I got the deposit for purchase of the team where I can go ahead. After I got the deposit, I'll go and buy the wreck. Fantastic. And in the meantime, I'm doing a deal at FPR to put race my wreck there that I'm buying off HRT, put that there, and I'm putting a driver there, James Courtney. So I'm putting all this together, and then, of course, I'm getting a sponsor, which Ford put together, Ford Motor Company, and which was Pepsi. So I thought this is going to work absolutely fantastic. Pepsi, James Courtney, FPR, fantastic.
And as it turned out, later in the year he would have the number one.
Correct.
To bring, which he didn't know at that stage.
I didn't know at that stage. I was hoping.
Nice, yeah.
But things went all belly up and all wrong at Bathurst. The media, we were on the front page of the paper. It was all a bit of breakup that, you know, it got out that I think Nathan Tinkler's going to buy it. And then he was worried in the contracts that James Courtney could get out of his contract, Adrian Burgess can get out of his contract, and the sponsors can leave. There was nothing really tied to DJR. It was sort of tied to me, sort of.
And contracts were going to be up at the end of that year for various
correct
elements and things.
Yep. So Nathan pulled out. Mm-hmm. Nathan completely said, I'm out, completely gone. That's the end of it. And then it all became very messy, and so Dick and I split everything in half, debts, cars, everything and all that sort of stuff. And well, not so much cars, but the wrecks. I kept the 18-car wreck, hence the number, and then Dick kept 17, and I leased it back to Dick for 2 years because then the Pepsi deal fell over and all that sort of stuff because James Courtney was getting more money off HRT to go there from Holden. General Motors threw more money in at Ford, and that all fell over too. So my world came crumbling down in a massive way, and it was it was pretty tough, to be honest.
True or false? I've heard both sides of this, that there were Pepsi Courtney cans printed and made. True? False?
False. 100% false.
Okay,
damn,
there we go.
There you go.
Oh, no, I've heard
there was a pilot.
Times.
There was a couple of pilot cans made.
Right.
But there was no actual cans made at all.
Okay. So if anyone's got one out there.
It's a pilot can.
It's a pilot can, or you've made it yourself and you've made it all up.
Correct. So, no, okay. There was none ever done. But
right.
It was a long, long, long way down the track. And, of course, Pepsi stayed in the sport, fortunately, with Greg Murphy. At Kelly's with that.
And they ended up at FPR a couple of years later anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
The Pepsi Max crew and you were there later
But
too.
Yeah, it was a very messy, sad time. And, of course, going into the 2010 season, yeah, it was it was messy. It was and of course, then CrimSafe, Dick needed a partner to help and Steve Brabeck, who's unfortunately really passed away a few years back now, but he sort of tipped in from where I left and invested a lot in the team to keep the team going because obviously Dick needed to find someone to keep the team going and make it all work.
Looking back, is there anything you'd do differently in that three-year period?
Probably lots, yeah. There's lots of things I'd probably do different. It's a shame. It'd be great if it was still there today, if you know what I mean, you know. But, yeah, it's just the way it goes.
That's life.
Yeah.
2010 Sydney, feelings when everyone hits the wall, when James in the wall. What is it?
He's they're in the wall. All
they're
in
all
the
in the wall.
Wall.
The commentary cry from Matty White and Crompo and Scafey. The patch-up job to get James back on the track is one of the most inspirational things I've seen in a pit lane in a long time. And the crowd on the pit straight in the grandstand that roared when this hobbling, wobbling 18 Jim Beam Falcon sort of rivers its way down the pit lane and goes on the track. Blokes have got burnt arms. They've thrown everything at this. That didn't win the championship, but it went so far to – yes, the points were valuable. It wasn't the difference in the end.
Correct.
But it's the bit that everyone remembers. Absolutely. Out of it all. Is that an inspirational moment that, yeah, you actually look back on fondly from that whole weekend that led to obviously the great result the day after that, you know, he won the thing and burnt the tyres off it and all that sort of stuff. But I reckon that's the bit that I remember.
Oh, for sure.
What stands out? Talk me through your weekend.
Yeah, look, it was – you know, I was mainly in 18 garage and Dick was always in 17 at the time. It was a little bit separate and we weren't really talking then either. But I was so proud of the team. You know, I'm still at the helm of the wheel and of finding everything, making everything work, and I'm still there. And but Adrian leading that team, it was yelling and get this, get that, and
a few other words in between, I'm sure, as well.
Absolutely. Just to get that car. You know, we've got one more lap. We've just get it out. And it was patched up so hurriedly. And the guys, and it's like any team sport, the guys just work their asses off. And James is sitting in the car and he's ready to go and out he goes. And we got it by one lap. And obviously Wincup missed out by one lap. And I don't think Winterbottom got out. But
no, that's right. It
was incredible, the excitement, the nervousness, the everything, and it was amazing. It was amazing teamwork from everyone on that team and everyone on those cars, and yeah, and everyone from 17 jumped onto 18 and made it all work. So
it was, yeah, it's probably going to be one of those things that we make a doco on in the years to come, because it's so far-fetched as a script. If you'd wrote that script, everyone would have gone, nah, you are on drugs. That will never happen. Yeah. All these leading cars crash, then they've got to repair them and go, oh, no way, that'll never happen. But it did happen, and it's 12 years ago now, which is quite unbelievable. So the other part to all that is the winning car, the championship winning car.
Yeah.
You've now got that car.
I do have that car.
So tell me the story about how this all – because that car, for those who love – people who listen to our podcast love the car histories. That's what we're a big part of sleuthing. So that car stayed at DJR for the following year, became James Moffat's number 18 car.
Yep.
And Moff was there for the next year of 11, used it for the first part of 12, and then they wheeled out a new chassis that had been sitting around for a while.
Yep.
But it was the end of the era, so they had to get that other car up and into the mix so as it could be then sold off and used. You can run a new car in the development series with a – you got to get the okay, but in the rules you had to run, I think, 5 rounds or something before you could run it on. So that chassis then sat around for a while. DJ put it back together. I was involved in a little deal that helped sell it to a collector, Terry Smart, who was the CEO of JB Hi-Fi. I think he's back there now, I think.
Yeah, well, he's a good guy now. But what happened at the time, I remember calling yours truly, I'd love to buy that car. Mm. And it's going to be big money though. I thought I'd really love that car because obviously it means a lot to me, and so did the other obviously 18 car that Will drove, which I owned as well.
Yeah.
But I really wanted that car, and but Terry, basically, I rang Terry. He was my neighbour when That's we lived right. in Melbourne, yeah, yeah. And we were mates. And he rang me. I bought the car, and I thought, bloody Aaron Noonan. I thought you were going to sell it to me, Noons.
Well, I was acting on behalf of people who want to sell the car, but it all worked out okay in the end.
Well, it did.
He was a great – I tell you, Terry owned a couple of other supercars as well. And
correct.
Wonderful collection of cars, and some of those supercars have ended up in other hands now. But he was a really passionate guy about not just race cars, but probably more road cars as well, Terry, too. But he was a – I think you'd see over the years with collectible cars, sometimes they end up in the hands of people who don't understand – why they're special. They just sort of buy them because they can and whatever. But really passionate guy who really loved the cars and really understood why they were special. So it didn't sort of end up on a wild goose chase of going through 17 other hands before you eventually purchased it, what, a couple of years ago now?
Oh, no, to be four, I reckon four or five years ago. Yeah. And I had a phone call from Terry. I'm going to sell all my collection off. And I thought, far out. But I'm going to sell them in one batch. And I can't buy the whole lot, and what am I going to do?
Are there any Studebakers in among there?
No, I haven't got any Studebakers, but So I thought, yeah, here's an opportunity. And he put me in touch with the guy, forgotten his name at the moment, that bought them, and he bought the whole cars and he was going to sell them all off. He didn't really want the Ford. The Ford was the odd one out that he didn't want. And I said, yep, 100%. So I bought the car off him, and Terry gave me the book and the other bits and pieces and got all the log books and everything. And, yeah, really proud to have that car today because it's such history.
Oh, yeah, totally.
It's a very special car. And obviously it was really, really restored really well by DJ. It was fantastic.
And you've got, am I right in thinking, I walked through some of the office here earlier, there's some trophies and some bits connected from that period that that car earned back in the day.
Correct. So I did do a deal with Ryan Story, which was really good and kind enough that I purchased all the trophies for that car. So I've got them all, and which is really special. They belong with the car. And so we've got them all here in Team 18, and yeah, it's great to have them. Really good.
And you mentioned before too, we should cover it too, the BF. You bought that before the FG. That was some years earlier. So was that part of – my memory's foggy now. I actually remember sitting down with you and doing a little sort of history on this car for you back in the day. Well, didn't it sit for a time in your garage on the Gold Coast?
It did.
Yeah, that's right. I remember coming to look at it there.
Its last race was the – ironically, I think it was the Jim Beam 400 at Oran Park.
Oh, the last round in 08, which was the last ever V8 round at Oran Park.
I think it was the Jim Beam 400. I'm sure it was. But anyway, that was the last race that car's ever done. And then the team decided we're going to sell it and all that. And I said, I'll buy it back in, 09. And then so I kept it at Waverley Forklifts in Queensland there for a while. And then when we all split up in 2010, I bought all the bits and put it all back together and then completely restored it later years. Back when we got things done with the race team here.
And it's in Will Davison 18 livery. 2008 livery of basically how it won Eastern Creek pretty much.
Correct. That it is. And it's only ever done a few laps. We did a few laps at Adelaide 500.
About four years ago. Something. It was the 20 years of the event.
Correct. Reasoning. And they wanted some cars. And and I think
was Matty Brabham.
He drove it for me there and did some laps. And
that's right.
And so it's great to have both those cars in my car collection that I've got. I think the Courtney cars down at my dad's car museum down in Arthur Seat Red Hill at the moment on display down there, which is really exciting. Oh, it gets a lot of people in there to have a look at the car.
And what is that, open to public?
Or
Give it a plug. Tell people.
There you go. Yeah. Well, it's called Charlie's Auto Museum down in.
Now, we should say your dad's names.
Is Charles, and his father, my grandfather, was Charles. So
it flows on.
It does flow on, and I got a daughter called Charlie. So that's down at Purvis Road Main Ridge or Arthur Seat down there near the chairlift at the top. There's about 80 cars there. It's really cool. And I've got the Courtney car down there on display. And, yeah, a lot of people just come down to see that because it's hard to see sometimes. And, yeah, it's great, really good. And he's got an amazing car collection, as I said, with 70 or 80 cars of a lot of odd stuff.
Odds and ends. That's cool. You never know what you're going to find. That's the cool part about sleuthing old cars.
Yes.
The Will Davo car, where does that live?
That's in Queensland at my little man cave. I've got an office up in Queensland with lots of collectible cars up there. It's on display there. And, yeah, no, it's really cool.
Oh, cool. Well, we've talked memorabilia and we've talked collectibles, so that's a little way to plug for me. The motorsporttrader.com, who are a partner of ours. They do a bunch of memorabilia and old car panels and parts, all sorts of stuff that they're selling. Have a look at their website. It's themotorsporttrader.com, keeping motorsport memories alive. And that was part one of my chat with Charlie Schwerkop. Next week, part two will drop on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco, and we talk about a bunch of stuff. We focus on the Team 18 era with Ford Performance Racing, Walkinshaws, and then going out on his own with Team 18 as a standalone operation. Charlie will also tackle your National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions as well. If you're looking for some presents, we are here to help. Go to the website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. We have a bunch of amazing motorsport books, magazines, model cars, DVDs, prints, we've got it all. There's something for everyone. Jump on the website and go shopping now. Subscribe to our newsletter via the v8sleuth.com.au website and follow us on socials, Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. You know the deal. We're pretty active there. We love to hear from you all as well. Right, that's it. We're done for the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco this week. Stay with us next week for part two of Charlie Schwerkop. And if you haven't listened to all the back catalogue before, go on through and listen to some of the old episodes. There's some great chats with stars of Aussie motorsport. I'll chat to you next time.